From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Some people collect art, and others collect vintage cars or maybe stamps or coins. Gerald Chang collects houseplants, and in his latest book, The New Plant Collector, Gerald suggests some gorgeous possibilities with detailed guidelines for figuring out how to make a good match for your growing conditions before you invest. Ready to add some houseplants? Well, more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Daryl Chang, better known as at Houseplant Journal on Instagram, uses all the technical insights available to him to make the countless houseplants that share his Toronto home thrive. He's the author of a previous book, The New Plant Parent, and creates the popular website houseplantjournal.com. How are you, Daryl? It's good to speak to you again.
Hi, Margaret. Nice. Good to speak to you as well.
You're so busy all the time. You're so productive. Another book.
Yes, okay. Yes. Very exciting.
Yeah, we'll do a giveaway. I'll do a giveaway with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. So that will be a way for people to enter to get a copy of the book, which I've been reading. Thank you. It's very enjoyable. And of course, now I want all the plants, but that's another problem altogether.
Yes.
A couple of years ago, when your first book came out, we did a podcast together and about your approach to matching each kind of plant with the right light conditions for its peak performance. And I'll link to that interview for people who didn't hear it. And I see on Instagram and elsewhere, you know, you're still at it. You have your light meter in hand a lot of times. You know, you don't go by a casual assessment of the mm-hmm. conditions, but you really go by data and making solid matchups, as I said in the introduction. And so just for those who may not know your approach, just sort of give us your brief version of the sort of your thinking on light and why you have that light meter a lot of times at the mm-hmm. ready.
Yeah. So, I mean, like my background is engineering. So I took like, I sometimes call my talks like an engineer's approach to houseplant care. And so if we just really just plain look at a plant as a kind of machine, you know, it is really just a solar powered sugar factory. And those little sugars are what sustain, like give sustenance to the plant. So when I approach, you know, how should I take care of a plant? Really the first thing I consider is light. And when I started using a light meter before making my own, I realized that light levels varied like dramatically based mostly on the size of your window or how close you put a plant to the window. And yet most plant care advice, house plant care advice in particular, never really addressed that critical difference between light, like potential light levels, so much as, you know, at least the way I did in my first book, and for sure the way I do in my second book.
Yes, and it is a measurable thing in other mm-hmm. disciplines. It is light is something that is, think of photography, for example, you know,
exactly.
I mean, it is something that is measured. So, you know, So you've availed yourself of that kind of knowledge, and it's fascinating. So speaking of light, there's been so many technical advancements, it seems like, in recent years in the products to help us light our plant growing areas better. And, you know, I see like these, I think I read about it on your website, I see these LED grow light bulbs that sort of almost look like an old style light bulb that you screw into a socket mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. it yields 150 watts of light, but only uses 12 watts of power. You know, it's an LED and, you know, it's like maybe $20-something. It's not a fortune and it's not emitting a lot of heat and it's not 7 pounds or something. You know what I mean? It's really a lot of progress, isn't there?
For sure. And actually technologically speaking, I would say we live in a kind of golden age as a houseplant owner because, think 20 years ago before we had readily available white LEDs, the only LEDs were those kind of weird purple colored kind, and they were also very expensive. And so today, as a casual owner of houseplants, if I wanted to keep, let's say, a cabinet full of plants, but away from a window, those, white LEDs, you can buy like a 2 foot long something that can fit inside the cabinet. And, these light fixtures, the ballasts are not like the old days of fluorescence, which are really heavy and need lots of electrical work. But these guys can just stick at the top of a cabinet very easily. And so it gives a lot more opportunities for collectors like me to own these, tropical plants that also they don't have such high light requirements compared to, well, I don't know where we're airing this podcast, but let's say, growing tomatoes in your basement. It's not, requirements are not nearly as high as for that kind of growing. So it is kind of a golden age, especially now that, we have white LEDs that are cheap and re readily available.
Yes. In the new book, you begin by offering us some guidelines for collecting plants should we decide to surrender. And you call your guidelines, they're your ABCs of houseplant appreciation, because there's a lot of plant possibilities out there, but we definitely need a way to sort of filter intelligently. So what are the ABCs?
Sure, yeah. So the ABCs are A for aesthetics, so you can appreciate how a plant looks, right? Its beauty, the structure. Then there's B for biology, and that is just appreciating how the plant grows in its, the way it sends out new leaves, maybe if it flowers, or even as you propagate, the way that it continues growing after you cut it back. And C is companionship, and that is quite simply that, you can have a sentimental attachment to your plants. And the example I always say is like, if, I have a particular rabbit's foot fern that I really like, but if you just took it away and replaced it with the identical type of plant, it wouldn't have the same meaning to me because it's not the one that I grew.
Right. I have my grandmother's clivias, and I mean, that even if someone gave me a different clivia, I saw that you got one in the fall or last year sometime.
Yes. And also, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it wasn't from my grandmother. However, it was from a garden club sale. So my local garden club, they always have plant sales. And so then when I saw the clivia there, I knew I had to get one because I heard about how much this plant is often passed down in generations and how it's just so prolific.
Yes, it is. I suspect mine is 80 plus years old. It's
Wow,
now
that's
many
amazing.
plants. It's many, many plants. And that's not an unusual story. I've met many other people who have ones that are old ones, but now it's many large plants, not just one plant. But and speaking of companionship, and you just alluded to it, speaking about purchasing yours at a garden club. There's the Begonia Society or the Gesneriad Society or the Orchid Society or the, one can also have human companionship and make new acquaintances and get new knowledge through plants, through sharing plants and, going to plant events and so forth. So that's kind of fun, too, whether we
I
do
think,
that virtually or in person.
yeah, for sure. And I also think I would hope that maybe because of, in social media now that it's very common to have like a plant account, that that has maybe given a resurgence to plant societies that, because that's the in-person version of plant clubs or online kind of thing.
Yes. So, you make a good point in the book that in all things collectible, whether it's antiques or whatever it is, the word rare is an interesting word. It's used to describe a collectible. And what it usually is like a neon light flashing that says, expensive, expensive, expensive. We're going to make you pay for this. And so,
Yeah.
but it can mean a couple of things for plant collectors, yes.
Yes. And I in the book I try to make a good point that which is not my own idea. It's actually from Mike Rimlin from Costa Farms, because he stated that there's kind of two different concepts of rare. The first is for a plant, I mean, and the first is rare just on the earth, right? And
Yes.
so these are the kinds of plants you really don't want to be collecting in your home. You've got to leave that to professional conservationists, biologists, or botanists, and those kinds of things, right? Not something you want to have in your house. But then there's just rare in cultivation, in commercial cultivation. And that just means that maybe the plant is not widely cultivated. Or it's maybe very slow in the way that it's cultivated, and therefore not a popular plant to grow in a greenhouse, for example, because every plant that's grown in a greenhouse requires time and space. And so if you choose to have one that takes a long time, then it takes away the space from something you could sell faster. So it's
Right.
that those are the kinds of plants that I think a lot of people are seeing online with quote unquote rare. And I mean, yes, they are rare and special in the sense that you can't just buy them at the grocery store. And the fun thing now is that when people realize that, oh, specific plants are ones that people really want, then if it happens to be easy to cultivate, then like a mass producer will cultivate it and then hopefully bring the price down and let it be available at your local grocery store.
Right. Some plants that we could collect, and you have like I don't know if it's the back half or two-thirds of the book, how much of it is kind of almost genus by genus, of plants you would recommend considering collecting and some of the special ones within that genus. And it's each one kind of starts with an introduction, but then there's almost like a chart that says, this is what its needs are. This is what this particular kind of plant's needs are, and you speak about the light and the other things that it needs, so that again we can make a good match and be realistic as before we go out and acquire things that we then can't make happy and have a disaster on our hands.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, I think begonias are a great way to get into plant collecting. They look, well, we used to call them fancy leaf begonias, but they look fancy. They are showy. They're distinctive. There's so much going on with just the foliage, and even and yet they're not always. There's plenty that aren't super expensive and rare. You can still get a great, beautiful assortment. You have one picture in the book, I think, that has like a display of them on a table, and
Yes,
it's gorgeous. It's like this nicer than any group of any floral arrangement to have a group of begonias all together. So,
oh, yes, for sure.
What's if I want to become a begonia collector, like what kind of a home, what kind of a home should I give them? Are they demanding light-wise, or what's their sort of profile in your
So
estimation?
in particular in the begonia section, this section is a little longer because in fact, I a lot of the my learnings of begonias comes from like as you mentioned, begonia societies. They have whole societies based just on the begonia genus, right? And so there are specific I guess you could say classes of begonias, but in the book I only talk about two main ones, which are the cane types and then the rhizomatous types. And so I split that up in the book, but also and as you mentioned, for all the chapters, the section that talks about their care, I think the important thing to note about how I describe the care is that I try and make it more parameterized. By which what I mean is that for every like environmental condition that I mention, it's something measurable and concrete that you can actually assess for yourself in your own space, right? And even within the light section, for example, of the light in the environment section, I break it up into three categories, or I guess context of lighting that you might have. So if you're doing it natural light with through a window in your room, then I give some parameters for that. And if you're going to do purely grow lights, I give another parameter for that. Namely, like the parameters you need to actually achieve the same light level that I'm suggesting. So you need to measure it at the leaf, and then keep the grow light on for 12 hours, let's say. And basically the point is then when you read this section, I would hope that it's not vague or just kind of like giving you some broadly defined thing like bright indirect light, and that you put your plant where you think it's bright indirect light, but then you'd start like I would say, oh, if you actually measure it, is it actually over 200 foot candles in most of the day or not, right? And but rather than give you a vague thing, I say it directly, 200 foot candles minimum
Or
kind of thing.
else.
Yeah, or else the plant will not do well.
And you have a great chart, I think, on your website as well, that kind of, for a lot of kinds of plants, gives some of the numbers and so forth. I mean, besides in the book, I feel like, isn't there a reference on
Yes,
your website as well?
exactly. Yeah. In fact, if you I think if you just Google bright indirect light requirements by plant, my website will be somewhere. I mean, it used to be first all the time, but
And
it's somewhere there.
I'll give the link with the transcript to that because that's very helpful. It's just very important for us to, not just go shopping and go ooh and ah and grab with the pretty faces, but but to say, hey, can I make a home for this plant?
That's right, yeah.
I mean, so I was going to say, I think begonias are a great thing to collect because I think our money, obviously there's some very unusual ones that are rare and expensive and so forth, but compared to say the monsteras, the Swiss cheese plant,
Yes, yes.
which have become like a thing, and we're talking a really serious investment in many cases because they've become so collectible. I feel like you can still get into begonias and have a gorgeous collection without, mortgaging your house or whatever.
Yes, for sure, yeah.
So the monsteras, on the other hand, this they're like, I was interested, you explain about the, speaking of light, that you observe some varieties are, they're called Swiss cheese plants, so holes in the leaves or lacy leaves or however we want to describe it, and that some are more inclined toward more of that openness in the leaf shape according to how much light they get as well. Is that correct?
Yes. So I mean, I didn't do a rigorous A/B test experiment, but I did do one very clear case example where I took the pup from a monstera. So when I say pup, I mean the very, very tiny little growth that comes off the side of a monstera that has very small heart-shaped leaves, so solid leaves, right? I took that off, potted it by itself, and then stuck it under a grow light where I would measure 1,000-foot candles, and it was on for 12 to 14 hours a day. And in that condition, by the time that little plant put out its fifth leaf, that fifth leaf already had like a full set of fenestrations, like side cuts on the sides, and then even some mid-rib fenestrations.
And that's what they're technically called, is fenestrations. The it's like positive and negative. It's like, again, it's like Swiss, that's why they call it the Swiss cheese plant,
Right.
right?
Yes.
Because
Yeah. So fenestration, I guess, comes from the French word fenêtre for window. So they're talking about basically any like holes or cuts on the leaf that makes it look like Swiss cheese.
Right. So we could spend some serious money here, or we could get a more basic one. But what I found fascinating also was in that section of the book, and I think it may have appeared in some other places as well, you talked about a gadget that I really didn't know about, which is these moss poles. I've seen them, the old style ones where someone in a greenhouse situation made a device to make a plant go vertical. But I didn't, now they're a product even, aren't they?
So I think, yeah. Sorry, continue.
No, but so tell me about moss poles because those come up in the book and you train some plants that
So I
way.
think at the nursery, prior to the craze of people getting really into houseplants, the moss poles that were available at the nurseries were simply like long fiber coco coir that was wrapped around a post. And if you were trying to grow, let's say, a pothos or a monstera up that type of moss pole, it's actually very difficult to get the plant to root against it because the core doesn't really hold on to much water. And of course, the inside of the post is hollow.
Okay.
When I'm talking about the moss poles that I'm referring to in the book, and the way that a lot of my friends online, let's say, have grown their really, really large pothos, it's actually a sphagnum moss filled inside a structure, like a plastic structure, and one side of it is a little bit open, let's say with like a mesh of some kind, and that allows the vine to root into the sphagnum moss because, of course, sphagnum moss is like a sponge, so it's easily
Yeah.
moistened and stays moist.
So you made these, it almost looks like coated hardware cloth, like, that's been, like painted or whatever hardware cloth. It's like so you made this pole and you stuffed it with the moss and then let the plant kind of
okay.
Because that's what I didn't know is if there was actually a commercial product now like the one you showed in the book, because I see there's all the other ones that, as you say, are more solid. But I didn't know if the kind that you recommend are also available or if it's a DIY kind of.
Yes. So there are several people who sell like just kind of like the plastic outer part.
That okay.
You buy it and then it's already pre-cut and everything. You just wrap it and maybe fix it cool. together with some zip ties. And yeah, so there are products out there for people who want to grow like this. I mean, because the reason why people want to grow an aeroid type plant up a moss pole is because then its leaves develop into the mature state much faster.
Right. Right. Well, it looked gorgeous. And you had a picture in the book, like almost like a room where there's different varieties or different species standing next to one another, each one sort of trained up a moss pole. And they're stunning looking. They're gorgeous, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. And so that's the appeal of doing that with your aeroid type plants.
Well, I loved it. I adopted a Syngonium two springs ago at the garden center. I was doing some, you know, mixed containers for the seasonal garden, you know, outdoor containers, and they just looked good. And I thought, oh, I'm going to use them as sort of the spiller over the edge of the pots with, you know, various other things. And then at the end of the season, I didn't have the heart to sort of let them die. I'd never grown one before, but I potted them up and brought them in, and oh my goodness, they're like a mile long. easy are they to propagate? And there's you in the book, you have some gorgeous ones that have pink splashed leaves and so forth as well.
For sure.
Nice ones.
I think learning propagation as a way of just fundamentally understanding it with your plants and seeing it as a constant thing that you do with a plant then allows you to really enjoy the plant in the long term. In the book, for certain genus types, I have like a kind of diagram. Like, I don't know if you noticed them, but like a kind of circular diagram where the plant starts off in a presentable phase and it grows bigger and looks even nicer, but eventually maybe it gets a little too gangly and starts to look a little less presentable. And then I tell you that you should, you know, propagate it however it's supposed to be propagated, whether by stem cutting or leaf cutting. And then for a while, the plant may not look so presentable, but hopefully it's coming back around to look nice again. And that's sort of like the idea to say that, yes, your plant may not always look the greatest, especially right after you've pruned it off or for propagating, but that there's always a path to get it back to looking presentable again.
Yeah, well, we have maybe 3-4 minutes left, and I was going to say, speaking of things that need to look presentable again, hopefully, I've grown begonias, you know, like rhizomatous and cane begonias for a million years, but something about this year, it's just funny. I mean, I'm in the same house; it's not any different. They summered outside like they usually do in the same place. Blah blah blah. Didn't change anything else, but boy, they really have taken a beating. They are really unhappy this year. And I think, okay, you know, I'm going to do, especially with the ones that have the rhizomes that sort of look like caterpillars spilling over the edge of the lip of the pot, I'm definitely going to be doing some serious haircuts, I think, you know, cutting back into the plants and seeing what happens. But it's sort of time for that, I think, a little cleanup for those of us who, you know, summer our plants outside and then bring them in, and they tend to decline a little bit. I don't have all the lights you have. I do want to get some of them though, because I think it's, because you have these supplemental lights and more ideal conditions 12 months of the year, are you feeding year round? Because I don't feed in the winter because the low light, the conditions are such low light, relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Are you feeding year round?
Yeah, when I talk about fertilizing for houseplants, especially the ones that don't go outside, that means they could have a growth spurt in the middle of December. Like I see a bunch of new leaves coming out of the stems, then I know it's actively growing, and therefore I will be, you know, using fertilizer. And I do it such that I actually have the slow release pellets in the soil, which means every time I water, it releases a little bit of fertilizer in there.
Yes.
And so therefore, every time I water those plants that have the granules, they are getting fertilized every time I water.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're not, but in the off season, are you adding it to your watering can as well, additional
Yeah,
or not? Yeah,
for some
for
plants,
some
if I
things
don't
that,
have
yeah.
if I don't have the granules in them, then I will be putting like a liquid
Yeah,
fertilizer
because
into the water.
they're in a high light situation or an adequate light situation. They're not suffering like some of my poor babies in
Mm-hmm. Well,
my.
yeah, and of course I do now that I live in a house, I can I there are like my huge monstera, for example, is outside in the spring and summer,
Yes.
but then now it's kind of in my basement under a rather weak grow light just to kind of keep it alive until winter.
Yes.
And I'm so for that one I'm not fertilizing because I don't expect any
Okay.
leaf growth to
Okay.
come out right now.
Okay. Well, Daryl Chang, I always love talking to you because I just love that you are so thoughtful about, again, making good matchups with your plants and about, just being such a good plant parent. But I
Thank
think
you.
so many of us have learned so much from your work and what you've shared on social media and from, I mean, you have everything from a course to you do consultations by email and, like helping people with their sick plants and all kinds of things. And now the new book, which, as I said, we'll have a giveaway with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com. So congratulations on that. And thanks to all of you for listening. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening, including with houseplants. Meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.